Good evening. Welcome to Congressman Capuano's telephone community meeting. My name is Allison, and I'll be moderating tonight's discussion. We thank you very much for joining us tonight. If at any point during tonight's conversation you would like to ask Congressman Capuano a question, just press *3 to begin that process. At some point later this week, we will post an audio file of tonight's discussion on our website. If you'd like to access that file or to sign up for Congressman Capuano's electronic newsletter, please visit our website at www.house.gov/Capuano. If you do have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3 to begin that process. And with that, I'd like to turn the call over to Congressman Capuano, who would like to make a few opening comments. Congressman?
Thanks, Allison. I just want to welcome everybody on the call tonight. We'll be on for about an hour or so, and obviously if you can stick around and listen, I think you'll find it enjoyable and hopefully enlightening. I'm just going to make a few introductory comments, and then I'm going to open up for questions so that people can formulate their questions they want and hit *3, and we'll begin it in a few minutes. But basically, I'm just calling tonight mostly to listen to people and to inform anyone who wants information to the best of my ability about what's going on down here. And I think everybody has listened all about the super committee and the fact that they couldn't make a deal and what it might mean for us. And I think that some people tend to get a little carried away with exactly what this means. It's going to mean massive cuts across the board because that's what was voted on a few months ago with or without the super committee. The super committee simply would have said, make these massive cuts in this particular direction. Now with sequestration, we face the likelihood, it's not guaranteed yet, but the likelihood that the cuts will be across the board. And those cuts will be dramatic for a long time. They will be 10% roughly, some will be 7, some will be 10, every year for the next 10 years, starting in January of 2013. So we still have another year to go through this massive debate about how to make these cuts and how to make our budget work. It's a very important debate, and it's a very serious subject, and there is no easy answer. Some people want to raise revenue. I am amongst them. I think we should raise some revenue. Some people want to cut. I also think that we should cut. I actually think there should be a balance between some cuts and some revenue raises. Unfortunately, there are many people down here that will just never raise revenue from anyone for any reason. And, of course, I think that's a recipe for disaster because, most of my constituents, and I count myself amongst them, we like the programs like fuel assistance. We're going into a heavy winter. We're going to need help for some of our people. I like WIC, which is food for pregnant women and young children. I like public education. I like supporting our local police. I think those programs are worthy of our support. I want to fix our bridges. I want to build the Green Line. I want to do all the things that we need to do, and all of that requires revenue. And I think that's how this country became a great country. I certainly agree that we have gotten ahead of ourselves. But we've gotten ahead of ourselves on a couple of things. Yes, we spend too much, but we also raise too little. And I ask anyone a very simple question. Was the country and were you better off before the Bush tax cuts or after them? No one likes paying taxes. I'm no different than anyone else. But at the same time, it is the price we pay for a civilized society. We didn't build the interstate system without raising revenue. We didn't create a wonderful public education system without raising revenue. We don't have the greatest military in the world without raising revenue. If we want those things, we as Americans have to finally realize that they cost money and we have to help pay for it. Now, granted, it's a fair debate and a good debate to argue about who should pay for it. I fall into the category that progressive taxation is a good thing. I do not fall into the category of wanting to harm rich people. There's nothing wrong with it. It's America's dream to make a few bucks, and God bless people who do. At the same time, if you make a few more dollars, then you should be more than happy to share them with society to help build those roads and bridges a little bit more than a person who struggles to make ends meet. I don't think that's a real difficult or radical position, but some people think it is. They think no one should ever pay taxes, and therefore we should never do anything. And I respect that position. I just really strongly disagree with it. That's the debate we're going through now. We will go through this debate for at least a year. It will be a major factor, if not the single major factor, in the upcoming election, how we should do this. In the next month, we're going to debate whether we extend unemployment insurance for people that have been unemployed for a long period of time. We're going to debate whether we should extend the payroll tax cut that really benefits working people and a couple of other things, but those are the two major items that will affect most people, and I don't know where they're going to fall. And I don't know what's going to end up happening. But that's what's going on. And I guess just on a final note, I'll also tell people that it should come as no surprise to people that we have massive differences of opinion down here, and it's hard to come to conclusion. Because the people that run for office, me amongst them, when I come to my constituents and say, please reelect me, and if you do, I will protect Social Security, I mean that. It's not a joke to me. I don't take it lightly, and I will do everything I can to protect it. And when I come down, I have people who have run for office in their district saying, I will change Social Security. It's very difficult to come up with compromises when someone wants to destroy it and for me who wants to save it. That doesn't mean I wouldn't tweak it to make it last longer and make it stable, but it means I will do nothing to destroy it. So when people get elected of strong opinions, it should come as very little surprise that we have a hard time coming together. So I think, honestly, in many ways, America has to make a decision, the whole country, not just Boston, not just Massachusetts, but the whole country has to make a decision as to which direction we want to go in. Do we want a society in which we all are participating, or do we want a society where each individual is on their own? And those are both good statements, but they are significantly different views of the kind of society we should have. And until the American people make a decision generally which way they want to go, and therefore elect people who will vote that way, we're going to continue in this difficult situation of having a hard time coming up with compromises. So I think with that, I'm going to stop and see where questions want to go, and let's have some good discussion.
And if you're just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, just press *3 to begin that process. And our first question comes from Ned in Cambridge, who would like to talk about Social Security. Ned, whenever you're ready.
I'm all set.
Hi, Ned. How are you?
Mike, fine. I call you Mike because I met you years ago, and it's former city planner from Cambridge. And your city planner introduced to me. You were a great mayor of Somerville. Now, Mike,
thank you.
Social Security, as you know better than I do, I'm sure, is a totally separate program. Congress does not appropriate money for Social Security.
That's
I'm
right.
Looking at a fact sheet here, which I'm sure you have more updated than I do. Everybody who has Social Security deducted from their weekly or monthly wages have now built up a trust fund of over $500 billion. And each year now we're adding to that trust fund. Why, I'm asking you, last year, by the way, was actually 2009, we added $154 billion to the trust fund because the retirees like me drew less money than the workers put into the fund, and the difference was $154 billion plus added. Why is it that congressmen and women talk about cutting Social Security as though it were a federal program?
Well, it is a federal program. It was created by Congress years ago. I mean, so it is a federal program, but it's a federal program that's funded through direct taxes, the payroll taxes. And I will tell you that, simply put, there are some people that have always hated Social Security. There are many of us around who remember from the old debates where people thought it was a socialist plot. FDR took a lot of hits for that. So that it's a basic philosophical difference of opinion as to whether society should chip in a few dollars to make sure that every senior can live a dignified life, or whether people are on their own. But I do have to add, the Social Security, though it's not in immediate trouble, over the long run, it does have to be changed, because when it was passed, I don't remember the exact numbers, but the average age of people in the 1930s when it was passed was probably 65, 70 years old. The average age now is 85, or whatever the numbers are. But people are living longer. They're working longer. And I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it used to be something like it was 6 workers putting in, 1 worker taking out. It's now down to 2-1. So that we are coming to a point where we do have to address Social Security. We may have to make some tweaks to it. but tweaking it to make sure that it's stable, to make sure that it's there for the next generation, is not the same thing as the philosophical argument that Social Security is a bad idea. But I do want to be clear. Social Security was created by politicians, and the funding mechanism was created by politicians. So it is a federal program. It's just one that happens to be funded by a direct tax that was leveled and drawn together by elected officials back in the 30s.
If you're just joining us tonight and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. And our next caller is Andy from Cambridge, who would like to talk about No Child Left Behind. Andy, your question?
Good evening, Congressman Capuano. The Congress is faced with reauthorizing the No Child Left Behind Act passed in 2001. Most people, including the Secretary of Education, think that the law was a mistake as written. It's got very, very little support. The Senate committee has put together a bill that's much more modest and would focus on the worst performing schools in the country instead of all schools, or the most focus would go on the worst 5% of the schools. So my question to you, Congressman, is, where do you stand on the No Child Left Behind Act reauthorization if it comes to voting this session or next session?
Well, Andy, I can tell you that I voted against it when it was first put up. I've been involved with education reform for a long time now, and I have never supported education reform that focuses almost exclusively on testing as a means of education. I don't think that's the best means of educating the next generation. I do think it's an important element, but I don't think it's the means to do it, and that's what I thought No Child Left Behind did, and I still think it does. So it depends on what the reauthorization has. If it's a straight reauthorization, I will vote no again. If it's a reauthorization that has amendments in it that will address the real concerns of urban schools and will address the real disparities of education that we have in this country, of course I'll read it and I'll consider it at the time. But they're having trouble doing it because, obviously, in order to really change our education system in the country, no matter which way you think it should change, it will take money. If for instance, a classic example is a longer school day. Well, if we're going to ask people, teachers and custodians and administrators to work a longer day, it's reasonable to suggest that we should pay them more. I don't think anybody that I know would say, I'm happy to put in an extra hour or two during the day and not get paid more for it. So that's just one example. No matter what we do, it will probably cost some money, and that has been the hang-up. There's also a hang-up on exactly how to do it. I think that there are a lot of people in this country that have come to the conclusion that, yes, testing is important, and it's a critical aspect of measuring both children and the system. But there are other things at stake than simply regurgitating information. So I can't answer the question until I see a bill. And when I see a bill, I will read it and I'll review it, and I'll make my best judgment. But I did vote against it when it was passed the first time, I have pretty solid opinions and pretty solid standings on the kinds of things that I want to see.
If you have a question tonight for Congressman Capuano, please press *3 to begin that process. And our next question comes from Ellen in Brighton, who has a question about FICA taxes. Ellen, your question?
Good evening, Congressman Capuano. Good evening, fellow constituents. I have a question regarding FICA withholdings. I'm wondering why there is a cutoff point for once somebody hits this year. I think it was about $107,000.
Yeah,
next
like
year it'll be about 110. People in that category, and I'm including myself, are in a perfect place to continue to contribute through the end of the year. It seems like Social Security and Medicare are where we really need to raise some money, and why would we not look at that revenue route?
I think you're 100% correct, Ellen. We have a cap only because we have always had a cap. It does change, I think, pretty much every year. I don't remember where it started, but I think the numbers you had relative today are pretty much correct. But we've always had one. There has been lots of debate and lots of discussion, and that particular item is on everybody's list of something to consider if we can ever get around to amending and fixing Social Security for the very reasons you suggest. It's a good source of revenue to stabilize Social Security. People in that income group, again, they're not wealthy, but they can afford a few more dollars to help stabilize the most important program we have. And I don't get too much objection about that. So for me, that is one item that I would seriously look at. But it would have to be done as part of a comprehensive plan to do something with Social Security. I mean, we're not going to do it piecemeal. We're going to have to do it. We're going to have to do a comprehensive thing. And the truth is, Social Security is a very difficult thing to take on politically. But we will have to do it eventually. And I will. I won't guarantee you, but I'm pretty certain that that particular proposal will be. I won't say it'll be first, but it'll be high on the list of most everybody who will be looking to strengthen Social Security going forward.
Sam from Cambridge is joining us now with a question about public transportation. Sam, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Thanks. Hi, Mike. Thanks for making the call. And you've been a great advocate of public transportation, and I'm curious about how we're doing as far as extending the Green Line and how things look for Amtrak.
Well, both of them are shaky, and it really has to do with, most of our funding for, especially for transit and highways, the railroad's a little bit different, but not much, has been done through the gas tax. We have not touched the gas tax in, I don't know the exact time, something like 20, 25 years. We've been paying 18.3, I think it is, cents per gallon for the last 20, 25 years. And everybody knows you cannot get today for the same amount of money that what you got 25 years ago. Yet that's what we do with our infrastructure, which is why we have less and less money available to fix our infrastructure, including things like extending the Green Line, but also fixing it, making sure that it runs on time, and all the other infrastructure. That's why we have so much trouble keeping up with our bridges and our roads. And again, it goes falls right back into the general category I talked about earlier. We built the interstate system. We built subway systems across this country on the basis of general taxation, and mostly gas tax, but there are other things as well. And for some reason, people think that we can continue to keep these things maintained and keep them running without looking at these or other sources of revenue. So unless we do something on revenue, there will be very little infrastructure money for repair or extension. The Green Line will be amongst them. I'm a strong advocate for the Green Line, but again, money is money, and we can't build it without it. As far as the Amtrak goes, that's a little different. The Amtrak is going through a national review. It always is. It's always subject to serious debate. Obviously, those of us who live in the Northeast tend to have a little bit stronger and more positive view of it because we see the real benefit, particularly between Boston and New York and New York and D.C. And it's the perfect place for Amtrak. But, of course, the rest of the country, which would have to support and approve any funding going to Amtrak to improve it and to get it up to a true high-speed rail, they don't necessarily see the benefit. They look at it and say, well, what about us? So we have, when we passed things like the stimulus a few years ago, we had to give, we had to split that money up across the country to be fair. And places got it that are looking to build high-speed rail, but they don't have it yet, as opposed to Amtrak, which I think would is a much bigger and much better bang for the buck to improve what we already have, to prove that it can work in the most densely populated segment of this country from Boston to Washington. And we are doing it. We've got, again, I don't want to give total numbers, but several billion dollars going in Amtrak over the next couple of years to improve it. It won't get it where it needs to be, but it is a step in the right direction.
Loretta from Chelsea is joining us now with a question about Afghanistan. Loretta?
Good evening, Congressman Capuano. I just wanted to say, what was your position on pulling the troops out of Afghanistan, especially when you consider that the Pakistani army doesn't really seem to support the U.S. at all?
I've been calling for a troop withdrawal from Afghanistan now since 2009. And I want to be clear, I voted to send troops to Afghanistan. I thought it was the right vote then, and I still think it was the right vote because it wasn't the situation we're in now. At the time, that's where Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda was. And our job, and I think rightfully so, was to capture and kill al-Qaeda and to make sure that they couldn't attack us again. And the only reason we went in is because the Taliban, who were running the country at the time, very bad people, but we weren't going after the Taliban. We were going after al-Qaeda, but the Taliban decided to side with al-Qaeda. So that was their choice, and we did what we had to do. At the same time, I never supported, and I do not support, the use of the U.S. military to rebuild another country. And that's really what we're into now. Al-Qaeda is not really in Afghanistan. They have moved like terrorists do. They don't sit there and fight you in an old-fashioned stand-up fight. When the U.S. military knocks on the door, they go someplace else for pretty obvious reasons. So they have gone other places. They have gone to Pakistan. They've gone to Yemen. They've gone to Africa. They've gone to other places, and we should continue to chase them. But the fight, for the most part, is not in Afghanistan, which is why I've been asking for U.S. troops to get out now for several years, and I will keep pushing for that until we get it. I know that the Taliban are bad people. I know that it's not good for the people of Afghanistan if they come back, and we should train the Afghanis to defend themselves and support them to the best of our ability, but not with our troops. And, by the way, I want to be very clear, there are a lot of bad people in the world, and we cannot police the world to get rid of them all. And if we're going to do that, we will be in a constant state of war all around the world. And I don't think the American people would support it, but even if they did, I just could not.
If you're just joining us this evening and you have a question for Congressman Capuano, please press *3. Rick from Somerville is joining us now with a question about the Buy American Act. Rick?
Hi, Mike.
Hi, Rick.
How you doing? Listen,
good.
First I just want to tell you that I can remember when I was a little kid having a Capuano banner the length of my house for your dad.
Thank you.
I'm a lifelong resident of Somerville, and I heard something about a bill that was passed in the 30s called the Buy American Act,
yep,
which required any company that wanted to do business with the government, whether it be federal, state, or city, has to be in the United States. And it also required the government to only buy from companies that were based in the United States, provided there wasn't someplace else that they could get it and it wasn't manufactured here. I'd like to see us go back to that. I think it would force these companies that are moving out of the United States to come back if they wanted to do business with our government. And I think it would bring money back to the country that we're sending overseas. My next thought was that we should stop giving money to all these countries that vote against our policies or whatever in the UN. We've been giving them money for years. It's like paying a bribe. They're not coming through on their end. I think we should just stop it.
Rick, I can tell you that the Buy American Act is in law. It's still in law. It's still there, and we still, every once in a while, thump our chest about it. The problem with the bill is it is full of loopholes, and there's no consensus down here in order to really enforce it, number one. Number two is that it's not a standalone bill. If we're going to do that, we then have to have thoughtful tax policies and trade policies to encourage businesses and to stay here to do their business. We have had policies in this country now for 30 years since NAFTA, and it's gotten worse, particularly when we started trading openly with China, that basically encourages companies to go overseas. We reward them for doing it, and then we leave an open door so that they'll take their manufacturing overseas, pay people pennies on the dollar, if that, for working at their factories, and ship stuff back here at cheaper prices than we can do it here. And we encourage that, and we allow it, which is absolutely insane. And then we complain, well, we can't buy an American TV anymore because they don't make it here. They don't make a refrigerator or whatever it is. And the Buy American Act is a good thing, but the truth is it has been used as a political slogan for so long that it really – It is not a problem. It is there. It is enforced, to my knowledge. But most importantly, it's a hollow shell that really is just a title, because with all the other things, you cannot buy certain things American. And all, we allow them to buy American when it's assembled here as opposed to built here. So the thing is full of holes, and every time we try to fill those holes, people from areas where they don't manufacture, but they might do this assembly, then stop. You know, they show up on the door and they say, well, wait a minute, if you do that, we're going to lose our jobs because we're assembling these parts from China and it's qualified as made in America. So it's a right approach, but it is a very complicated answer. I mean, a very complicated action that we have to take to make it right. And the willingness here is just amazing. I'll give you a classic example. I don't know anybody who looks me in the face and tells me that NAFTA was good for this country. I mean, maybe at the time they thought it would be, but I hear nothing but people who believe that it really hurt this country. Yet just a few weeks ago, we voted for three more trade deals that, in my opinion, will end up shipping jobs overseas. It will be good for some businesses. But in the long run, I think that, and I'm not, I want to be very clear, I'm not against trade. America was built on trade. I am for fair trade, which means if you want to trade with us, then you have to also buy our goods. You have to allow us in and not tax us and not require us to hire your people to do business in your country. And that happens all the time. China is a classic example. An American company cannot do business in China unless it has a Chinese national as part of their leadership team. It is a requirement by law. We also can't trade with countries who steal our intellectual property. You know, this country is heavily into things like computer technology and radiology and things like that. And we have all kinds of intellectual property that just is blatantly stolen by other countries, and we allow them to do it. So I think you're 100% right, but it is a much broader-based approach I think we have to take to really be effective. And unfortunately, until people really connect all these dots, it's probably not going to happen, because we get people who get up here and they say all the right things, they thump their chest about Buy American, and then they immediately turn around and vote for a trade deal that is hurtful to America.
Kevin from Somerville is joining us now with a question about veterans benefits. Kevin, your question?
Hey, Mike, how are you? Listen, I'm from Somerville. I met you over at the DPW in Cambridge when I was working over there. Lifetime resident of Somerville. We'd vote for you no matter what. We love you, Mike, over here. The question I have is I was drafted and I served in Vietnam with the 25th Infantry Division, and I was wounded back in 68. And what worries me is the entitlement. We keep hearing about entitlements, you know. Am I in danger, us veterans? I'm 100%, by the way. Are we in danger of losing money out of our checks? The other part of my question is, I got a feeling that that Israel is getting ready to make a move on Iran. And how do you feel about that?
As a veteran, I can't imagine that you're in danger. I mean, there's a good question about veterans coming home, whether they're going to treat them with the same respect we've treated people in the past. And actually, from what I've seen, especially the Vietnam era veterans, I thought you got treated very, very badly by this country until recent years. And I think some of those things have been made better, but it took a long time, and I don't think we'll make the same mistake again with current veterans, but it's something to be aware of. But at the moment, no, I don't think it's reasonable to really expect that you're going to get hurt. At the same time, as far as Israel and Iran, I mean, Iran is a very, very, very dangerous country, and there are those people in this country that would like us to take action. I don't necessarily think that's a smart or worthwhile move. Israel's a sovereign country. I mean, if Israel makes a decision to take action to defend themselves, like every sovereign country, as I've said earlier, I don't think we should be the world's policeman in Afghanistan. We shouldn't do it in the Middle East either. We should have our influence, and hopefully that if there's any military action that might precipitate serious military action throughout the whole region, we will have our voice on it. But the truth is we have no ability to stop any sovereign country from taking military action to do things what they would consider to be defending themselves. But I want to be clear, Iran is a truly dangerous country, and I think anyone in their right mind should be concerned about them developing nuclear weapons.
Curtis from Somerville is joining us now with a question about taxes. Curtis, your question?
Thank you, Congressman Capuano. Thank you for this opportunity to ask this question. I am a Somerville resident, and I happen to be, one of those, few who happens to make a few bucks. And I have a great concern about the rhetoric in Washington involving class warfare. I think that it's fundamentally unfair to incrementally tax those few who pay the largest share of taxes. If you were to get 10 people in a room and figure out that, one person has to pick up the tab for a meal, I'm sure by popular vote you could get everyone to agree that that one person should pick up the bill because nobody wants to pay for it themselves. And that's sort of what's coming out of Washington. Whether it's the whether the wealthiest people in America should fund the payroll tax reduction, or whether it was increased taxes in healthcare reform, to pay for additional healthcare reform measures. It's the minority needs a voice and representation in Congress, and so it almost fails to raise to a serious debate to constantly point to those few who pay taxes in America as the one who have to pay for everything, including deficit reduction. So I guess my only ask is that when you go back to Washington and you talk to your colleagues about what needs to be done to do the right things and fix America, especially address deficit reduction, that the debate get a little bit more serious and stop pointing fingers at people who make money in this country as the only ones who should make a contribution. When 30 or 40% of Americans don't pay taxes and you have about, the top 1% paying something like, the vast majority of taxes in the U.S., for such a small percentage of the population, just something has to give. And I think that the bottom line, everybody needs to make a contribution, and we need to address what the big ticket issues are and make some hard decisions about how to cut back instead of talking about how to raise taxes.
Thanks, Chris. I hope you never hear me taking on any particular category of people. I don't believe in that. I do, however, believe in progressive taxation. And by progressive taxation, it doesn't mean only one group of people should pay the taxes. It means everyone should pay something. I guess you could argue that the lowest income people maybe shouldn't pay much, or if anything. But at a certain level, at a middle class level, everyone should pay something. It's a fair question to ask how much, but I do believe in the concept of progressive taxation, which means if you make more, you're willing to pay a little bit more. And I say that because, let's be serious, I mean, a person, and I'll just make up numbers, if somebody earning $50,000, it's okay, you can live on $50,000, you can live a decent life, but every $100 to a person at that level is a lot more important than $100 that a person making $200,000 or $1 million. It doesn't mean it's not important to them. It just means that their lifestyle will not change if they contribute a little bit more to the general welfare. So then that's the concept behind progressive taxation. Now, of course, there's always going to be somebody who makes political hay, and I can't help the way the media reports these things. The more extreme you make your statements, the more likely it is the media will play it. And that's true on every issue and on both sides of those extremities. So I try not to fall in those categories very often. Once in a while I do, but not when it comes to this. I do think that the wealthiest amongst us, and that includes me. I mean, I'm not poor. I don't have any problem paying a higher percentage of my income in taxes than somebody making, 10 times less than me. That's not a problem to me. It's a fair debate and a reasonable one to try to figure out exactly how much more we should be paying. That's fair. But I do not believe in a flat tax. I think that's totally unfair. I think that's class warfare. But I do think that some of the rhetoric is heated, but honestly, in politics, you get heated rhetoric, and in today's 24-hour news cycle, when they have to fill every minute of every day with some crazy statement, they do tend to quote those who are the most egregious on both sides, and I find it to be less than thoughtful and incredibly divisive, and this issue is no different. So I agree with some of what you say, but it sounds like we might have some disagreement as well.
Lynn from Roxbury is joining us now with a question about home ownership. Lynn, your question?
Hi, Congressman. My question is about how you stand guarding foreclosure and some of the debate that's going back and forth about proposing a bill in Congress or whatever to force banks to reduce principal and also do mandatory mediation before they do foreclosure. And I myself am in foreclosure, having lived in my home for 24 years, and it's a result of a predatory loan and a gentrification issue going on in my area.
I can tell you, Lynn, that I totally agree. First of all, I want to be clear. A lot of the problems were not banks. They were the non-banks, the non-bank mortgage finance companies, because they were unregulated. Some of the banks did it as well. but it was more the biggest problems we had were from the unregulated mortgage companies as opposed to the banks. But that's beside the point. As of today, with the problems we have, and it's, I want to be clear, my concern is, yes, for the individual homeowner like you find yourself in a difficult situation, but it's also for your neighbor. If your home gets foreclosed upon, it will hurt your neighbor's value, the value of their home. So it's not good for your neighbor. It's not good for your neighborhood. It's not good for the city. It's certainly not good for the country. And obviously, it's not good for you and your family. So what I would like, what I've been pushing for, and we've tried a couple of things, and none of them have worked because no one is willing to force it to be done. I do think that even if we can't get them to forgive principal payments, they can be restructured. The typical loan is probably over 30 years, and most of these loans are in trouble have something less than 30 years available. Well, if that's the case, let's take those principal payments and put it over 40 or 50 years and reduce the interest payment, because it's really not so much about how much you end up paying over a period of time. It's how much you pay every month. Can you make that monthly payment? And most people in homes, not everybody, obviously, there were some people that got homes that just should never have gotten those loans. But that's not the average person. The average person just has, you know, they either lost a job or somebody gets sick, or they might have got a difficult loan situation, or they can't get it rewritten. But right now, I don't know your situation, Lynn, but there are many people in your situation, you may be one of them, who are not eligible to take advantage of the lower interest rates that are out there now, because they're already in foreclosure and the bank says no. I think that's crazy. Society and the bank is better off if you simply are able to pay your bills and keep your home. There's very few people who benefit from taking the home away. So I would argue that the federal government should be requiring not just the banks, but also the mortgage companies to rewrite most of the loans. Again, there will be some people who should have never gotten it in the first place because the numbers just don't work. But if the numbers work, they can stretch out the principal payments over a much longer period of time and reduce the interest payments so that the monthly payment is significantly lower by hundreds and hundreds of dollars. In the final analysis, the bank or the mortgage holder will walk away whole. The homeowner gets to stay in their home. More of them do. And they get to make ends meet, which is what it's supposed to be all about. But unfortunately, there has been no willingness in Washington to force the mortgage holders to do these things. And the mortgage holders are afraid of getting sued by the people that they owe money to, which I think is absolutely crazy. So I think if the federal government doesn't require it, it won't happen. So I'm very supportive of that concept. But I honestly wish I could tell you otherwise. I don't have a whole lot of hope that it's going to change in the near future, and I'm sorry to tell you that.
Clark from Somerville is joining us now with a question about the Citizens United decision. Clark, your question for Congressman Capuano.
Hi, Mike. I'm in West Somerville.
How you doing?
I've got the three obvious the Supreme Court decisions, the 1886 race in California, the Money Equals Speech of 1976 or something, and the People's United of just a couple of years ago, all of which are empowering corporations to contribute more and more money and control over our electoral process, which I find very worrisome. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious as to how you feel about that and what you see as there might be a way of dealing with people being able to contribute from corporate structures where the corporations can't vote. You know, how can someone who can't vote in an election, you know, contribute to it? Is there something along those lines? And as a follow-up question, I'm curious as to the Grover Norquist pledge. How is it, since the Constitution gives the Congress the authority to tax, that a person can come to the Congress and sign away part of their obligation to the citizens in terms of this Grover Norquist never raise taxes thing? Is that constitutional or is it?
Well, the Norquist thing is not a legally binding document. It's simply a political document that I promise I will never do this, or I promise I will always do that. And I will tell you that I've been seeking elective office now off and on for a long time. I have never signed a pledge, even when I agree with whatever the issue is. So I don't agree with Grover Norquist, but he's not the only one who asks people to sign pledges. And I don't do it because life is more complicated than a simple pledge that you might do on Tuesday. By Wednesday, things might have changed. So people do it. It is not legally binding. It is simply a political document that Grover Norquist would then wave back in somebody's district or their state saying, look, Mike Capuano signed this pledge and he's a liar, so why would you want to vote for a liar? So that's Norquist. As far as the Citizens United and corporate money coming in, I mean, the corporate money can't come directly to the candidates, which I actually think is a problem. I think this country would be better off, well, by public financing, but if we can't do that, then I would argue that we are better off if all the money spent on any campaign goes through candidates, because at least we have to file who gave it to us, where it came from, how much it is, and you, the voter, can make a decision whether you like where the source of money is or you don't. But the problem with the current situation, Citizens United, is that the money doesn't come to the candidate. It doesn't even go to the party. They can go to these, the Americans for a Better World. I mean, you just make up any name you want. And if you're wealthy enough, or if you're a corporation, you can just spend $100 million into this Americans for a Better World and put on TV ads and mail and all the other things that we all get through politics, and not ever, ever have to tell people where the money came from. So that, for the sake of discussion, Exxon Corporation could put $100 million into a new organization that they created that says Americans for a Better World, and put $100 million of TV ads in Boston saying Mike Capuano is no good. And as a regular citizen, you might see this and say, well, gee, who are these Americans for a Better World? They're saying Mike Capuano is no good. But if you knew it was Exxon, you might say, now I get it. Okay, I understand that. It is a huge problem. It has already impacted America. It's going to get worse. And I think that what we're trying to do, we're trying to get some transparency. So far, we have not had any success. And in lieu of getting transparency, because Republicans have been able to stop it, the next best thing is to at least force the people who own the corporation to be the ones to make a decision whether they want to do it. And the people who own a corporation are the shareholders. So instead of the CEO of Exxon deciding that he wants to spend $100 million, which under law he can do right now, I'm trying to change the law to say at the very least, then you have to get the approval of the shareholders from Exxon. And we can't even get that. We have had some success at the SEC. They've adopted a rule to do some of this. But people down here, the Republicans will never vote for something like that. But we're still working on it, and unfortunately it was a Supreme Court decision, an interpretation of the Constitution. I think it was wrong, but not much you can do about a Supreme Court decision except try to find ways around it, and that's honestly what we're working on very hard to do, and I hope the American people get pretty mad about it so that we can get something changed here.
Peter from Somerville is joining us now with a question about health care reform. Peter?
Yeah. Hello, Congressman, and hello, fellow. Doing well. Hello, fellow constituents. So my question is in regards to the health reform bill that passed and is going to the Supreme Court. It would seem it's very guaranteed now. In the event that the aspect of it that mandates everyone have health insurance, in the event that aspect of it is found unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, what do you think Congress should do, and what do you think Congress will do, or hope, perhaps?
The second part's easy. What they will do is probably nothing, because the people who got elected in the last election all promised to repeal this health care bill, so the likelihood of them doing anything is minimal, unless we change the people who are in Congress. What they should do, in my opinion, which is what we should have done in the first place, to me, the bill that we passed was a compromise with a compromise with a compromise. I voted for it not because it was a great bill, but because it was better than doing nothing, and it was what we could get passed. But in my opinion, a classic example for me, the best way to provide health care for more people is to do something like open up Medicare for everyone. That would be, to me, a much more effective way to do it. It's effectively a single-payer system, but it wouldn't be a mandatory single-payer system. At least it would be available and open for people if they had it. If the court says, which I actually think that there is some legal potential here that they might win, which I hope they don't, but I think they might. I shouldn't say I think they might. I think they have a chance to win. And if they do, then we're going to be back to square one. Then I still think it was the right vote because, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not the court. I'm a legislator, and I do what I can do. And hopefully, if I knew it was unconstitutional, I wouldn't have done it. But it's not that clear. I mean, it's a fair debate. But so I think what they should do is open up Medicare and do some sort of a health care for all type of thing. And if we can't, even if we can't require people that health care, at least make it available to them. But I don't know or suspect that will happen absent a significant change in the people who serve here in Congress.
Lisa from Somerville is joining us now with a question about Social Security. Lisa, your question for Congressman Capuano?
Yes. The cost of living increase seems to be going up tenfold, but yet the Social Security checks are not. I know a lot of us and including my mother, are having a hard time getting by on just the Social Security checks. Do you see that changing? And then second fold, this is coming from my 13-year-old son. He's appalled that we can help out so many countries, but why is there such a term as a homeless veteran? There shouldn't be such a thing. These people went over as a selfless act. They don't ask Democrat or Republican. They serve our country out of the goodness of their heart. When they come back, they shouldn't want for anything. They shouldn't have trouble paying their bills, finding a job, going back to school. He's not saying they should be driving Mercedes. He's not saying that, but he does think that they shouldn't have a need for anything because they put their lives on the line. Their families were put on hold. Their sons and daughters went without their dad. The mom was left, or the dad was left, to carry on in the place while the other one was serving. That there shouldn't be such a thing as a homeless veteran, and there should never, ever be a repeat and a disgrace of how the veterans were treated when they came home. It should never happen. And what can you do about that to make sure it never happens again?
Well, the COLA for Social Security is subject to a formula. The formula is set in law. It's been in place for a long time. The last couple of years, there was no Social Security increase because the formula didn't call for it. We attempted to give a $250 across-the-board payment to everybody to kind of make up for it. It just didn't pass Congress. Kind of simple. But this year, this coming January, I don't remember the exact percentage, but I think it's going up in the 2 to 3% range, again, based on that formula. As far as returning veterans, I mean, people need to remember, again, that is that's all of that would be paid for with tax dollars. And I just want to point to World War II. The original public housing that most people think of today, no matter where you live, it was probably built originally as veterans housing. I know that's the case in Somerville. They're both Mystic and Clarendon were built as veterans housing right after World War II, and that it was. So we have not done that since World War II because this country wasn't as committed to it. I do think that veterans today are being treated a lot better than they were when they came back from Vietnam. Not as well as they were treated after World War II, but they're certainly being treated much better than after Vietnam. So that I can only tell you that if we don't want to have homeless veterans, we have to build more homes. It's kind of simple. I don't think anyone would suggest that someone should be thrown out of their home in order to make room for somebody else. So that if we want to do it, we have to build more houses. And we have to provide the subsidies for them to be able to pay the rents that they can afford. Absent that, then it's just talk. And that takes money, that takes commitment, which means one of two things. Either we have to cut something else, I know some people think that the government is full of waste, fraud, and abuse, and there's always some waste, fraud, and abuse. Of course there is, but it's not the kind of money that people think it is. Or we have to raise revenues to do this, and I personally think that that's a perfect thing to do. That's the right thing to do, but up until now, the discussion in Washington is not about new revenue. The discussion is all about cutting. And I think that is not going to change until the next election. So if you want to take care of fellow Americans, be they veterans or not, then I think that you have to accept the fact that we live in a society where we want to do that, and we have to be willing to participate in it.
We have time for just a few more questions this evening, and if we don't get to your question, we do apologize. You will have an opportunity to leave your question on a voicemail for Congressman Capuano at the end of tonight's call. Karen from Charlestown is joining us now with a question about Sullivan Station. Karen, whenever you're ready.
Yes, hi. Good evening, Congressman.
Hey, Karen.
I should say I'm originally from Somerville, too. I feel like it's a Somerville reunion.
Sounds
on
like
the
it,
phone
yeah.
Tonight. I know that a while ago.
But don't
ago,
forget, Somerville's just Charlestown at one time, too.
Right. I know a while ago you had a meeting in the city,
yep,
about the overpass bridge. I was just wondering what the outcome was of that and if that bridge is ever going to get rebuilt.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it depends. There was, to my knowledge, the city is still not working on the North Washington Bridge, so that's still pending. But the discussion was about Rutherford Ave. And we had a meeting. We've been working with the city ever since to try to come up with a compromise position because the Charlestown was basically split in half. Some people wanted to get rid of the underpasses at Austin and Sullivan, and some people did not. So I've been working with the city now for several months. I believe they're soon will be coming out with a possible solution to it. And as soon as they do, I believe firmly that the Rutherford Ave will be done, and it needs to be done. The money is there. and we just have to get it right as opposed to just do it because we want to do it. It has to be done right because if we do it wrong, you'll be stuck with it for 100 years. And that whole debate was about not just Rutherford Ave, how it affects Charlestown, but how does it affect the region, and will we be driving people into the residential area, which, of course, is crazy. So that I can only tell you that we have been working, I think, cooperatively with the city for the last several months, and I think I'm sure that they are working on an alternative proposal that I believe they will be floating within the foreseeable future.
Lynn from Brighton is joining us now with a question about the president's jobs package. Lynn, your question?
Yes. Hi, Congressman, and thank you so much for your very hard work on such important issues and your positions on them. I really appreciate it. I had two questions. One was how do the moderates in Congress seem to have fallen away, and watching an analysis and just wondering how, I'm trying not to lose faith, but, you know, how do we get away from this terrible, terrible polarization and what can we do about it? And my second question was about a jobs program. When President Obama first came in, I hoped he was going to borrow from the Depression era and try to do something along the lines of the WPA or the CCC or something that would really be visible, active, you know, get something happening that people could feel and experience, and put them to work. And Robert Reich has been promoting this for quite a while, and I think he's very realistic and probably has ways he thinks it can be done. Is there any hope for that? And can the president act on that from the executive position at all, or does that require Congress?
No, that would be required Congress. The president wouldn't be able to do it on his own because he wouldn't have the money to do it. I totally, 1,000,000% agree with you. I think it's what we should have done more of with the stimulus. It should have been an entirely done relative to a WPA type of thing. I will leave the WPA for another debate, but I thought it was a brilliant program. I think it worked perfectly well. I think it was certainly relevant to today's society. The problem is that, in the attempt to be bipartisan, the president decided that he was going to compromise with the people who didn't like that kind of approach, and he did, and still they didn't vote for it. So it amazes me. I don't understand why you have to compromise with people who don't support you. I understand people who disagree. I'm not calling them names or anything, but if you're not going to – if I bend and you don't, that's not compromise. That's capitulation. But anyway, it's where it is. So the likelihood of it happening now is probably non-existent. Again, people have to remember, we had a massive election last year, but Congress was changed dramatically. It was the largest change in Congress since the 1920s. The people here now, they will never vote for a proposal like that. Even though I personally think it is the most important thing that the government could do to actually create jobs. As far as the president's jobs program, there's no way in the world they will ever vote for that. And even then, the president's proposal is a decent one, but the vast majority of that is tax cuts. And I don't think that the most tax cuts create jobs. And by the way, for those people who are skeptical about the stimulus, an independent group just came out 2 weeks ago with a study that showed that the stimulus created well over 3 million jobs and saved millions more. So it wasn't perfect by any stretch of the imagination. I think it could have been a lot better. But creating 3 million jobs and saving millions more, I think, is a pretty good record. It could have been better. I would have liked to, again, I think it would have been better if we had done a more direct action, like your suggestion with the WPA. But, again, you have to make compromises in life, and that bill was a series of compromises as well. But as far as I know, and my estimation at the moment is, with the people who run Congress at the moment, there is no chance at all for a job creating bill at all, other than what they think. They think somehow cutting taxes for everybody will create jobs. And I think that has been disproved repeatedly over generations. It has never worked. I don't see any reason why it would work now.
We have time for one last question this evening, and if we don't get to your question tonight, you will have the chance to leave Congressman Capuano a voicemail at the end of the call. And our last question comes from Mary from Somerville, who would like to talk about compromising in Washington. Mary, your question?
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Michael?
This
is Mary Louise Daly.
Oh, hi, Mary. How are you?
From Somerville.
How are you
doing? I'm good. My question is, I'm doing okay. My question is this. You are a very conscientious, smart capable, trustworthy representative, and I trust your opinion. Do you have any thoughts on how this impasse in Congress can be solved between the Democrats and the Republicans? It's getting ludicrous. They act like children, and I think the American public is getting fed up with the whole thing and is losing their trust.
I actually hope they are fed up. I've been fed up with it for a while. I honestly, Mary, I can tell you it's a longer story than you're going to want to hear, but I actually think that the problem lies less with the people who are elected and more with the people who elect them. And here's what I say. I mean, there have been a lot of people who've checked out of the system, and they said, I just don't like it. I don't get the perfect candidate. I don't like what they're doing, so I'm not going to participate anymore, and I'm only going to vote every 4 years for president or whatever it might be. I'm not going to vote in party primaries. I'm just going to show up when I feel like showing up. And what that ends up doing is when people walk away from the process, even though the process is messy and the process is not perfect, but when they walk away from it, you have to ask yourself, who is left at the table? And the people left voting in party primaries, and not just in Massachusetts, but all across the country, tend to be the less thoughtful people. I mean, that's not a way to put it. They tend to be the people who are more fervent about their opinions, as opposed to people who are more willing to compromise, because those are the people that tend to get fed up. And when you have fervent, vehement believers on both sides who dominate a primary, then you're going to end up with nominees who are more fervent and more in their belief and therefore less likely to compromise. And I suggest take a look at what's going on with the Republican presidential primary right now. I mean, they've had 14 different leaders in that primary every week, and it's a function of who can be the most outrageous and who gets their support that week. Until the American people as a whole get reengaged in the system, then we're going to be left with a divided country, and I actually hope they do. Now, I happen to think that if more people got involved, that the views that I tend to hold dear would be the majority view. But if they weren't, I would be fine with that. If the majority of Americans said the best way to solve the problems is to have tax cuts for millionaires, well, fine. I don't agree with that, but I don't believe that's true. I believe that most Americans agree that, you know, we have to have some revenues on the table here to really address our problems, and we can compromise this thing out, but that means you have to give up some of your core beliefs, not a lot, but some, in order to find compromise. But when we keep getting people sent here on a regular basis that refuse to compromise, refuse to even discuss it, there's no hope. And the only hope I have is that at some point, exactly as you said, is that the American people finally get fed up and send us more people who are willing to compromise. I'm talking to a friend, Mary, you know, I compromise. It doesn't mean I don't know it, and when I do, I will tell my friends and I'll tell everybody, look, this is not what I want. I just did it on healthcare 10 minutes ago. Healthcare wasn't what I wanted, but it was the best I could get, so for me it was a compromise. I voted for it because something's better than nothing. And I'm not ashamed of that. That's natural life. If I only voted for things that I personally thought were perfect, I would never vote for anything. So I think the only way that happens is for the American people finally to understand that with all of the problems, with all of the difficulties of the democratic system that we have in this country, it requires the American people to be involved. It relies on them. And if they walk away in droves, which is what they have done for the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, it doesn't mean you won't have a president, doesn't mean you won't have a Congress, it just means you'll have a more divided country. And I think it's something that I'm looking forward to the American people getting back reengaged in, even if they don't agree with me.
And with that, we have to end tonight's telephone community meeting. We thank all of you for joining us. If you did not get a chance to ask your question to Congressman Capuano, you can leave a message at the end of this call. And I know Congressman Capuano would like to say a few closing remarks. Congressman?
I just want to thank everyone who listened. My expectation is there aren't too many who stayed on the whole time, and I wouldn't expect that. But I hope that you found it enlightening and thoughtful, and don't expect everybody to agree with everything I said, but my hope is at least you walk away knowing that there's some thought behind a lot of this and that these issues are difficult. I know most people already know that, but they are difficult, but the only way we'll work these things out is to talk them out. So I just want to thank everybody for being involved and wish everybody a good night.